Morning Slaves. This past October 15th marked the 50th fucking anniversary of the founding of the Black Panthers in Oakland, California. As resistance to white supremacy and police terror once again heats up in the United States, there are many lessons to be learned from the Panthers' revolutionary program and the insane fucking lengths that Uncle Sam went to stop them. So, to help uncover some of these lessons and how they apply to present-day struggles, I recently caught up with Yonaina and Lorenzo Comboa Ervin, two former members of the Black Panthers and current members of the Black Autonomy Federation. Hey, y'all. How the fuck are you?
Hanging in there. Doing all right.
We're fine, bro.
You were both members of the Black Panthers back in the day. What led you to join the party, and what roles did you play within the organization?
Well, in my case, it was at an earlier stage. I had been part of another organization, a civil rights organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had gone over from civil rights by 1968, had gone over to Black Power. For a brief period, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee linked up with the Black Panther Party in 1967. They had alliance from 67 to 69, and that's how I got involved.
I joined the Black Panther Party because I saw all the things that were going on around the country in terms of police brutality, poverty, and oppression. And I realized that as an individual by myself, I couldn't do anything.
J. Edgar Hoover believed that the most well-organized and subversive element of the Black Panthers was his Breakfast for Children programs. What do you think he found these so-called survival programs so threatening? And what types of programs do you think might pose a similar threat today?
The survival program, particularly the breakfast program, was threatening to the U.S. government, because we were talking about feeding people who were hungry, children. We couldn't feed all the hungry children, but we fed as many as we could. And this drew attention to the fact of poverty in the United States, especially poverty against Black people in the country. That was really threatening because they didn't want that kind of thing to be highlighted at that time. So it was particularly threatening. There's a lot of hunger and poverty still in the United States. Obviously, we couldn't organize maybe in the same kind of way, but you had people who were who've been cut off from food stamps here in Missouri. They've cut off in March. They cut off 26,000 people from food stamps. So you drive by these food pantries, you'd see lines stretching for blocks. So there's still a need for those kind of programs. And if they had them today, it would once again highlight what's going on right now in this country. It's class warfare, war against poor, low-income people.
After your time in the Panthers, you later became more influenced by anarchism while remaining critical of the broader anarchist movement. What sparked this political shift? And what do you think are some of the limitations of the anarchist movement that impede its revolutionary potential in the United States?
At the time when I went to prison in 1969, Black Panther Party, the Black Power movement, was actually going through a stage of being attacked and crumbling. And so when I went into prison in solitary confinement, I was looking for something different in terms of organization. Also, I saw some of the errors that had been made by the Black Panther Party and other organizations in placing so much emphasis on leadership as opposed to mass struggles. And so my thing was, when I became an anarchist, it was with the one thing that did grab me was the idea that power should be in the hands of the people instead of in the state, and then the criticisms of the state. So I thought that was very good. And my being a political prisoner, my case was adopted by the Anarchist Black Cross as it was reformed in the UK. And I still think that it's anarchism has some serious political value. The problem is the organization and the failure to make the ties to communities. There's too much emphasis on activism and not enough emphasis on community organizing.
The Black Panthers emerged within the context of the Cold War, at a time of widespread national liberation struggle waged by Marxist-Leninist revolutionaries. How did this political climate affect the organizational structure of the party? And what role do you think this played on how things played out?
Well, we were in the Black Panther Party, we were very inspired by what was going on overseas, particularly in Africa, the African liberation struggles. We saw they had different models for how they were organized. In a lot of cases, they may have had a collective leadership, or they may have had what they call central committees. And we sort of saw ourselves as fighting the Black liberation struggle here in the United States. And to a certain degree, we tried to pattern ourselves after what was going on in Africa. Now, clearly, there were distinct differences because we were not in a shooting war with the U.S. government like many of the countries, the African Liberation Forces were at that time. But they gave us inspiration. We saw what they were doing, and we thought maybe it would be possible for us to overthrow state terror in the United States.
But also, no movement can supersede its own times. And the fact that the majority of revolutionary struggles at the time were Marxist-Leninist or at least were national liberation struggles meant that that's the form that would influence revolutionary struggles all over the world. And so there were errors made in terms of, you know, structure and so forth, but they were based upon what was seen to be the revolutionary currency at the time.
What are your thoughts on the role of social media, smartphones, and other modern telecommunications technology as it relates to the struggle against police and the building of a revolutionary movement more broadly?
I'm no expert when it comes to technology, but I am clearly able to understand how the ability to reach people with a message that you ordinarily would not have been able to reach. The Black Panther Party in this day was only able to reach people as far as its newspaper would carry it or word of mouth. And it was significant, to be quite honest. But the truth is, in this period, you are definitely able to reach a lot more people through computer networks, which is what, you know, social networking is. You can reach people through social networking a lot more people than you can or you could back in the day, even with the Black Panther Party.
I was really struck by the fact that the fiance, the girlfriend of the brother who was killed by the police up in Minnesota a couple of months ago, that she, I don't know if I could have done it, but she, you know, got on her cell phone and hooked up with a Facebook, I guess, video messenger and was able to let people, I mean, we actually saw him. He was sitting in the car dying. The police officer had a gun on her and her little girl. And a lot of people in this country do not understand how police terror has worked for so long against Black people and other people of color. And here was a prime example of how it works. So I think that it's excellent. A lot of people don't like to see it. It was a horrifying thing to look at, but sometimes you have to give people the truth, no matter how ugly it is. So I think it's very important, the role of social media and networking and computers and all that. To me, that was one of the most vivid cases of showing that.
You are both members of the Black Autonomy Federation. How is this group structured, and what types of issues do you organize around?
Well, right now we're trying to restructure it as a mass organization. And, you know, our program is called Let's Organize the Hood, which is really about community-based organizing, revolutionary community-based organizing. And so we're trying to get to the stage of building a movement of, you know, like all power to the people, you know, social programs, basically survival programs. And we're trying to get to the stage of, dealing with police terrorism, but understanding that we have to build a anti-fascist tendency. That was a good thing about the Black Panther Party. Early on, it recognized that it was the state that was the source of fascism, not peripheral tendencies like the Ku Klux Klan or others. It was the state. And they understood from the very beginning about fighting the state. So this is where we have an understanding that to deal with police terrorism, you can't just fight for reforms. You can't just fight thinking that they're going to stop committing their crimes against the people. They're hired to commit crimes against the people. They are a death squad. And that's what they're hired to do. And they've killed hundreds of thousands of people, actually, over the course of the last 30 or 40 years. Consistently, this has been going on. And in the Black community, the police are a occupying army and always have been. So this isn't new. What is new is the people themselves reporting it and organizing against it. It used to be when I started doing this a long time ago, when I got out of prison particularly, there was the family. There may have been one or two so-called civil rights groups. And if you're able to rally some forces in the community, that's what you had. You'd be able to get some people from other cities and other regional areas like we were able to do. But there wasn't a broad-based national mass movement as there is today. So that's a good thing. The bad thing is that that movement is basically limiting itself in terms of its demands.
What do you make of the current state of anti-police resistance in the United States and some of the specific calls for police reform that have emerged from its more prominent elements, such as Black Lives Matter? Are there other groups you agree with more in terms of ideology, strategy, and tactics?
Well, I think that the work that Black Lives Matter has done has been very important. I think it has, for a lot of the young people today, you know, they're becoming more aware of police terror. And I think Black Lives Matter has helped maybe to raise their consciousness on that level. But I think the limitation is that it has to get beyond a mass protest in the streets against particular incidents of police brutality. I'm not saying that should stop, but we have to begin to have a broader picture of how do we deal with police terror in the United States? How do Black and other people of color who are the primary victims of that, how do we defend ourselves against police terror? We have to go beyond just the individual cases and begin to build a broader movement. The Black Panther Party had, you know, fought police brutality, but we also had an ideology about oppression in the United States and the terror of the U.S. government. In fact, the Black Panther Party, in fact, which is getting ready to celebrate its 50th anniversary of its founding, was able to paint a broader picture of police terror in the United States beyond just the individual incidents that happened.
I think it's time that we go beyond reforms and begging or demanding of the state that it stop using its own gendarmes to murder the people. I'm sorry. What we need to think about is building a new kind of movement, an anti-fascist movement that wants to transform the whole of society, to understand that the police are an intrinsic part of the government. And we need to talk about how, in fact, we need to educate broad layers of people about what the police really are, what they really are, the police death squad. And what we're seeing is what has actually been happening for a long period of time here in the United States and other parts of the world. So this whole propaganda line about trusting the police and their right to patrol, and all, we have to challenge the police and the whole idea that we even need the police. If we were able to build a kind of society that was based on justice and equality and freedom for the people, we wouldn't even need police forces. You know what I'm saying? And so these are the kind of things I think that we have to get to that stage. Just like we talk about abolishing prisons, we have to talk about abolishing the police. And that leads us to the question of what kind of movement do we need? We need a movement that seeks to have a social revolution. That's what we need. We don't need a movement that's concerned about just making the bed of oppression more comfortable. We need to talk about smashing it completely, smashing the state completely.
One of the most enduring legacies of the Panthers was its embrace of armed self-defense against police. What role do you think that guns play in terms of community self-defense and building a revolutionary movement?
Well, you know, I think that the armed self-defense was very important when the Black Panther Party was started 50 years ago this month in Oakland, California, when Bobby Seale and Huey Newton first started the Black Panther Party. I think now we're in a situation when the police are almost on a daily basis in this country arbitrarily executing Black people and other people of color. I mean, you can have car trouble and stop your car someplace and wind up, you know, dead. Your family's planning a funeral and you just had car trouble like the brother did down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So they are executing people. They are a death squad. So we have to talk about how in our community do we begin to defend ourselves against this police terror. One of the things that we have to stop doing in the Black community is to call the police when there is a problem. This brother who got killed in California recently, he was supposed to have had a mental health episode. His sister called the police to get help with that mental health episode. Now she has had to bury, or is getting ready to bury, her brother. We in the Black community have to find out a way how to work with each other on our issues and problems so that we do not have to call the police. We begin to deal, you know, the Black Panther Party, we talked about community control of the police. Okay, we have to begin to have that type of control again in our communities, where we do not need to rely on the police, who are just going to come in and either they don't kill us, you know, they'll beat us up and throw us in jail for a lot of times for nothing that's of any real serious consequence.
Well, the whole thing about this period, we need to understand one thing, and that is, and we need to make the masses of people understand, which is more important than our understanding, is that we need to let people know what the police really are. We need to politically educate the masses of people. If they talk about Malcolm X making it plain, that was one of his strengths, of his ability to articulate. The Black Panther Party's newspaper was so powerful because it could take really complicated political theories and ideas and make them plain to the masses of people. We should be able to do that now to talk about these pigs, and that's what they call them back in the day. We should call them that now. These pigs that are consistently abusing the rights of people, that's one thing, but they're murdering people, outright murdering people. And there's no question that we have to talk about the building of the next movement has to be, it doesn't have to be totally an armed paramilitary movement, but it certainly has to be a movement that practices armed self-defense with an understanding of going then from to the stage of revolutionary violence as a means of not just defense, but transforming society, because they're not going to give up power without mass murdering as many of us as they can. And they're doing that now anyway. So we don't have any choice, but the community itself has to reach the stage of rejection of authority, rejection of the police. And that's the role of the organizer. The organizer has to be there agitating and pointing out that these people can't be trusted, that never will be trusted, and why they're criminals, a death squad, and that they have to be removed entirely. We have to push them out of our community.
At the same time as a movement against police brutality is taking form, the United Snakes is witnessing the largest prison strike in history. How do you think these two movements, which both disproportionately affect Black Americans, can better coordinate and link up?
Well, the whole issue of mass incarceration in the United States has developed over the last 30 some odd years or more with the war on drugs is obviously hooked up with, you know, by police brutality. The police use the so-called war on drugs as an excuse to go in and to arrest, you know, thousands of people. You know, the war on drugs and the police brutality that went with it and the mass incarceration today has decimated many black communities throughout the country. So there has to be obviously an understanding of the clear link between, you get arrested, there's police brutality, you get arrested and you may wind up being incarcerated in prison for decades. I think that the strike right now that is going on, the unprecedented strike that is going on, I think that the activists who got that started, who started the strike, the members of the Free Alabama movement, they're the ones that called for the strike nationally and they got it started. I think they understand that themselves, some of them having gone through that when they were younger before they went to prison. So the two have to work together. I don't have a blueprint for how they work together, but clearly we can't consider them as a separate forces, because the end result of being in prison, all this mass incarceration, is starts with the police brutality, the terror against Black people and other people of color, primarily, that's gone on in the country, that's going on.
Yeah, when I was in prison and during the heyday of the revolutionary prison struggle of 1969, starting around 68, somewhere around in there, and going in through the 70s and up to the 80s, when I was in prison during that time, there was a linkage between the Black Panther Party and the Revolutionary Prisons Movement. George Jackson, particularly, was one of the persons of note that had linked up with the Black Panther Party and became the minister, was the Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party at the time.
Field Marshal
of the Black Panther Party at the time. And so there always has been that linkage. Then when the Attica Rebellion took place as a result of his assassination in 1971, the Attica prisoners rose up and they were clearly a revolutionary force. I mean, you know, they saw themselves as revolutionaries. They didn't see themselves just as criminals asking for reforms. They saw themselves as revolutionaries. They saw themselves as being political prisoners. And they clearly linked up with the movement in the street. They had called all of the forces at the time that they saw, everything from the Nation of Islam, the Black Panther Party, and others, to come to Attica and be part of the negotiating team so that they can, you know, resolve some of the differences there. And to try, and the one of their demands was to try to get them removed to a non-imperialist country, which, you know, would have been some feat at the time. The reality is that they are linkages. They're all linked. You go to prison, especially for Black people, the experience of Black people going to prison is more than going to college. I mean, you know, we're used to going to prison when we are going to college. That we live in a police state. We live in a society where the police function of the state is an occupying army. Every day we are confronted with the police. And so the number of killings, the number of brutality and all that has happened consistently for a long, long time, but it has been covered up. It's not been seen by the majority of society. So when we talk about an anti-fascist movement, we have to include not just police terrorism, we have to also include the mass imprisonment of so many Black and people of color in this country and poor people in the prison system. We have to talk about that. We have to talk about inside the prisons, how they have used what used to be called behavior modification when I was in prison. Now they call it the special handling units or whatever for long-term confinement to try to break the will of people. You might be in solitary confinement. In one case, some of our brothers down in Louisiana was in prison 40-some years in solitary confinement. And others have been in prison, long-term solitary confinement. So this country, you know, you have to understand that the whole thing about prison slavery and the conditions of oppression in the street, they all link. They're all encompassing of what the capitalist system really means for peoples of color and for oppressed and exploited peoples, period. So yeah, it has to be linked up together into a mass movement. The issues are important. We can't allow the so-called nonprofits to take over the issue for that very reason, because they want to take the issue in an almost academic, a surgical fashion, claim that it's we can reform that, we can reform this. No, we don't need a reform, we need a revolution, we need a social revolution.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to, I sort of mentioned it a little bit, but I just did want to say that this is October, and 50 years ago this month, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale founded the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. That will be commemorated coming up in Oakland and other cities around the country where there were Black Panther Party chapters. That will be commemorated towards the end of this month in October. It's been half a century. It's hard to imagine that, but been half of a century since the Black Panther Party was started by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. Back in 1986, myself and the former Black Panther members, Madeline Rucker and Ralph Moore, we actually started the Black Panther reunion movement. Madeline, Ralph, and I organized the 20th anniversary reunion in October 1986 in Oakland. And so since then, there have been reunions in the Black Panther Party pretty much every 5 years since that, doing it on a five-year basis. So of course, with the 50th coming up in a couple of weeks, this will be the big one. You know, it's a time to reflect on the significance. The Black Panther Party, in my estimation, was the first organization in the United States, certainly the first Black organization in the United States, that dealt with the issue of state terror against Black and poor people. That's why it was ultimately wiped out by the federal government. So I think it's a time to reflect on the important contributions that the Black Panther Party made, the lessons that we can learn from that. Obviously, we live in a different day and time now. We can't do everything the same way, nor should we. Police brutality is worse now than when Huey and Bobby were walking the streets with the community patrols of the police 50 years ago. Police terror is far worse in the United States. But it will be a time to reflect upon the contribution, the important contribution that was made, something that I guess I had not really thought about. And 3 years ago, Lorenzo and I did a speaking tour in the UK during the month of October. They have Black History Month there. And at one point, a young Black student, I asked her, I said, you know, Lorenzo and I are curious, why are so many young people coming out to hear us speak? Because they did. A lot of people came out and they were young people. They weren't even alive when the Black Panther Party was existing. Many of their parents weren't alive. I said, why are you interested in hearing what we have to say? And she said, because you give us hope. And it really touched me. I hadn't thought after all these years, what the Black Panther Party did 50 years ago still inspires and can give young people hope. So it's a time to reflect, to look at the lessons, learn the lessons, but we live in a new period of history and we have to move forward. The Black Panther Party wanted a social revolution in the United States, not just reforms, a social revolution. That is what Lorenzo said. We have to begin to look at what is going on now, half a century after that, and what are the steps, what are the things that need to be done to move us forward in that direction.